This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, there is much change focused in on healthcare, health reform, and health policy.
Well, indeed there is. And in the aftermath of the election, President-elect Trump and the Republican majority in Congress are making much of the notion that the Affordable Care Act needs to be repealed and in short order. But most experts say it's not going to be easy to pull the plug on the full legislation without a sound replacement strategy, which so far doesn't seem to be in place. And under any circumstances, it's kind of hard to undo legislation, Mark, isn't it?
No, it is. And many of the nation's healthcare CEOs are now in a holding pattern, uncertain how a change in federal policy will affect their bottom lines. The general consensus is that until they know what Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements will look like in the years ahead, a majority are certainly urging the Trump administration to proceed cautiously before greatly disrupting the policies that have been in place for several years now.
And there's also concern about what the Trump administration will mean for things like scientific and biomedical research and programs like the Cancer Moonshot, the Precision Medicine Initiative. These are things our guest today is very involved with.
Dr. Keith Yamamoto is Vice Chancellor for Science Policy and Strategy at the University of San Francisco School of Medicine. He recently participated in the Milken Institute Partnership for Cures gathering and has some unique insights in what may lie ahead for biomedical research.
Well, he is certainly a thought leader on the future of science education, and we're really looking forward to his views, Mark. Of course, Lori Robertson will be checking in with us, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She remains on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Keith Yamamoto in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. There's growing unease within the healthcare community as well as the health industry regarding the future of healthcare in America and exactly what policies are going to drive it forward. The nation's $3.5 trillion healthcare industry has recalibrated these past 6 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and most industry insiders were not anticipating a Trump win in the presidential election. The president-elect has vowed to repeal and replace the law while keeping in place some of the more popular aspects, such as young adults staying on their parents' plans to age 26 and exemptions for pre-existing conditions. The hospital industry is particularly concerned over the potential of millions of Americans losing health coverage. The law has greatly reduced hospital reliance on charity funds to cover the uninsured in need of hospital care. Women's health services coverage are mandatory under the ACA, mammograms, birth control, cervical cancer screenings, no copays. Those services could also be at risk. Some attempt to privatize Medicaid is likely, and attempts to expand private Medicare Advantage programs look to be fairly certain. 1964, a seminal moment in the history of the U.S. Surgeon General's office. Smoking was then directly related to a number of deadly conditions, including cancer, in the Surgeon General's report. It has led over the decades to more targeted health policies that have curtailed the smoking habit significantly in this country. 2016 may prove to be a pivotal year for the nearly 21 million Americans beset by addiction. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a report detailing addiction as a medical condition and one that's far undertreated and costs the nation some $420 billion a year in lost revenue, accrued health costs, and incarceration expenses. Meanwhile, mental health and addiction services coverage still presents one of the greatest barriers to gaining and receiving treatment for substance abuse disorders. Still a long way to go to reach parity. Dementia is now down among the nation's seniors and not by an insignificant amount. According to a study conducted by the National Institutes of Health and National Institute on Aging, dementia has seen a 24% decline in Americans over age 65. In 2000, 11.8% of the nation's population was diagnosed with dementia, now down to about 8%. The study suggests perhaps advances in heart health through better hypertension management and diabetes management may play a role. Still, the numbers are staggering. Currently, 5 million Americans suffer from dementia. That number expected to triple by 2050. And this is your brain This is your baby's brain on too much screen time. Study on screen time and the developing brain was a topic for discussion at the annual gathering of the nation's neuroscientists. The study found mice brains exposed to 6 hours of lights and noises similar to video games had much more need for excitable stimulation than their counterparts, were more likely to exhibit high-risk behavior and had symptoms of ADD. But they were also less likely to become distressed in noisy, overstimulating environments that would upset those mice who weren't exposed. Scientists are still split on whether this is a good or bad thing in this highly overstimulated world. The report comes on the heels of the American Academy of Pediatrics relaxing its earlier stance on babies and screen time. Their previous recommendation was none before the age of two. Either way, the study showed significant rewiring of brain circuitry in the overexposed mice. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Keith Yamamoto, PhD, Vice Chancellor for Science Policy and Strategy and Director of the Precision Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. Dr. Yamamoto joined the UCSF faculty in 1976, serving as chair of the Department of Cellular and Molecular Pharmacology. He's also a leader in science policy, serving as chairman of the Board on Life Sciences at the National Academy of Science, as well as numerous government and public advisory boards, including the NIH Center for Scientific Review Advisory Council. Dr. Yamamoto is an elected member of the National Academy of Medicine, the National Academy of Science, and is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He earned his doctorate in biochemical science at Princeton University. Dr. Yamamoto, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Welcome. Pleasure to join you.
You know, you've had just an incredible career in biomedical research, along with a long history at the University of California, as well as a solid role as a thought leader in the world of national health and research policy. And I would say, as this election has wrapped itself up, that there are some very big matters that are unsettled in the election process around the issues around academic and biomedical investments that each administration was contemplating. And you recently participated in a panel at Faster Cures Conference where you weighed in on the opportunities and challenges for the president-elect. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners some revelations from that panel's discussion, some of which were surprisingly optimistic, and we are an optimistic people, so that is good to hear. I wonder if you could just share your views on the expectations that you might have coming out of a Trump administration around biomedical research.
Well, I think that the optimism that you heard from all of the panelists reflected hope. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty, as you said. Not much has been discussed about science during the campaign, or very little, maybe if any. So there's a lot of unknowns. There are concerns about things that Trump said and did that might be cause for worry amongst scientists with respect to his using evidence as a basis for decisions and so forth. But I think that what you heard was a level of cautious optimism that it's important for us to sort of back up, take a deep breath, sit down, and talk with the new administration. You know, I think there are many things that they need to know about scientific research, biomedicine, healthcare, that we don't know how familiar they are with it. Mm-hmm. You know, among them, prompt appointment of the NIH and National Cancer Institute directors, really being able to draw for them the direct connection between biomedical research and health and healthcare and healthcare costs, including drug costs. The imperative that the federal government has to do basic research, really opening the door for the private sector to be able to apply that new knowledge. The opportunity that the administration has to support grand challenges, to enunciate big goals that the scientific community might take on with federal support that would have impacts on really urgent societal issues. And just the importance of maintaining U.S. leadership in biomedical research enterprise as a whole, maybe just pointing out the importance and role of biomedical research and medicine as an economic driver in our present economy. You know, these are kind of needs to know in our view, mm-hmm. and it's really crucial that we sort of start with a blank slate, sit down, and try to talk about those needs.
Well, Dr. Yamamoto, I'm sure there's always a interesting array of thought leaders gathered at the Faster Cures Conference.
Right.
I know Dr. Francis Collins, head of the National Institutes of Health, who oversaw the Human Genome Project, was there. Certainly, he's been a very vocal advocate for more federal money earmarked for biomedical research. So the 21st Century Cures Act, we know, is a bipartisan bill. That's a good thing right there, launched in Congress. But what is the importance of that legislation? Can you tell us a little more detail about it?
Yeah, 21st Century Cures has been long in the making. Congressman Fred Upton, who's chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House, has been assembling and promoting this legislation for a couple of years. A version of it actually passed the House last year but didn't proceed through the Senate, and it's being rewritten as we speak with high hopes that it'll move forward during the lame duck session. And 21st Century Cures carries a broad spectrum of matters of support and regulation of research, drug discovery, drug testing, and drug approval at the FDA, research at the NIH, that I think capitalize well on the opportunities that have opened up with the big research advances that have been made over the past decade or two. For basic researchers with NIH support, I think a key thing is just additional support for that kind of research. It would move the NIH budget, which, as you know, has been in stasis for over a decade, finally being able to allow scientists to try to capitalize upon some of the advances that they've made. So a big bill, very broad-ranging, covering fundamental science and then moving drug development, device development, and approval more briskly through the FDA.
Margaret just mentioned Dr. Collins heading up NIH, and he's also taken on the president's latest research initiative, the Precision Medicine Initiative, which seeks a million citizens to participate in this, donate their biomedical and genomic information. And you are as well a leader in this area at the University of California at San Francisco. Am I wrong to say that you all have your own initiative open to all of the 20,000 plus employees at the Institute? Maybe you could share with us what you are doing within the university around precision medicine.
So, you know, it's actually worth backing up a step and talking about the overall scope of precision medicine. I was chair of the Board on Life Sciences at the National Academy of Sciences that sanctioned this report, and that was beautifully chaired by then UCSF Chancellor Sue Desmond-Hellman and Charles Sawyers, a noted cancer researcher at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York. And it was a great report. It published at the end of 2011 and made a series of recommendations that they really saw maybe three things, that to try to build a continuum of research so that all of biological information from fruit flies through populations of people could actually be used in decision-making about advancing further research, on the one hand, and about diagnosis and treatment and prevention and cure of diseases in people. Secondly, to define disease mechanisms so that we can actually classify diseases according to mechanisms instead of symptoms and organs mm-hmm. and things of that sort. Because it's really in revealing mechanisms that we can really find approaches to being able to treat or prevent diseases. And we're seeing examples already of being able to come across diseases that for which there's no present therapy, and then find that, oh, the mechanism is the same as this disease over here mm-hmm. that looked unrelated, but now there's already a therapy already there. And then finally, to be able to discern all the factors that contribute to disease so that prevention, diagnosis, treatment, cure can be focused all the way down to the level of the individual. Those are grand goals, and that's what precision medicine really does. It's a revolutionary approach to research, health care, that seeks to integrate vast amounts of data in order to achieve those ends. And so the million citizens that are being engaged in the Precision Medicine Initiative cohort is a part of that by bringing together a group of people that say, yeah, I get mm-hmm. it. I want to share mm-hmm. my data because I know that if I do, and along with a million other people, we'll be able to learn from that in ways that will help everyone.
Well, Dr. Yamamoto, I can tell you that within our community health center circle, and we're participating in it as one of the PHOs, it is a subject which just generates tremendous enthusiasm. You know, you have made the point so often that we're at a crossroads and that the academic right. world of biomedical research is also at an important pivot point. You were appointed the first vice chancellor of science, policy, and strategy at UCSF, supported the notion that the world of academia has to be redesigned in some ways to reflect the 21st century era of scientific advancement. You wrote a very compelling piece about the university of the future and why that mm-hmm. needs to be given serious consideration and what you think it would look like.
You know, what's happened with these remarkable advances in research is that the sort of the lights have come on between fields that were thought not to be related, between ideas that weren't connected. And when those lights come on, the possibility of doing something really bold, of asking a big question mm-hmm. that we hadn't been able to see before, becomes evident. And so this University of the Future idea speaks to the fact that the traditions and policies, on the one hand, of the federal system for funding research, and on the other hand, amongst us, academia, the academic policies for hiring and promotion and so forth, are a conservative force that is actually inhibiting the capacity, or at least not encouraging the capacity for scientists to ask these bold questions because they don't get rewards for them. So that's what the University of the Future says, is what if we put together a system, and the one that I talked about was the self-assembly of teams of scientists who choose to go after a hard problem from multiple directions, multiple disciplines, teams that come together that say, hey, you know, if we work together, we have an opportunity to nail this problem, and we all know that there's no way we could do it individually. So the system of focusing on individual achievements in academia is holding back that possibility of groups of people getting together, choosing the problem by themselves, and going after it as teams. And the precision medicine approach, as you know, proposes building a huge computational so-called knowledge network that links together all kinds of information about biological processes, about disease, about people, about experimental systems. And that will allow sort of visualization of these possibilities that you know, a single human brain can't really put all this stuff together, but a computer can. And so the idea is that in the University of the Future, increasingly, we'll be able to sort of sit down at our terminals over lunch hour and find investigators, maybe within UCSF, who could, working together, go after a problem and solve it, a really bold idea. So we need to build a system that recognizes the value of that kind of team effort and rewards it.
We're speaking today with Keith Yamamoto, PhD, Vice Chancellor for Science, Policy, and Strategy, Executive Vice Dean for Research at the School of Medicine, and the Director of Precision Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. You've really had a revolutionary approach to this whole concept of how we should start conceptually thinking about where our research dollars go. And you've been a little concerned that we've broken things down by, you know, organs. And not these disease right. mechanisms. But for the common citizen, how do they make that connection? Because so much of the resource, the funding, really align with something that is really a siloed approach that cuts us off from the vast potential when we have a much more integrated world. But how do you sort of square that up with sort of the political funding aspects of the mm-hmm. research community?
Mm-hmm. You know, when resources are limited, and they are, then a flaw, an intrinsic weakness, our system for funding research emerges, that the peer review system, which is the best way in the world to allocate research funds, becomes conservative. The research is being reviewed by peers, and peers are the people that are doing the present work, and their first line of defense is to defend the prevailing paradigm in a given area. Mm-hmm. And so a research grant application that comes in with a wild, crazy idea that's going to show that that paradigm is wrong is not going to be welcomed with open arms right away. And the review panels take on sort of a cost efficiency expert feeling where they say, well, is this experiment really going to work? The higher the probability of it's working, well, maybe those are the ones we should be funding. We won't waste any government dollars. And, of course, bold ideas have a risk for failure. And the University of the Future idea says that this idea of research teams would be stamped out multiple times per faculty member. Let's say that established lab faculty member might be involved in 10 teams. It would be fantastic. You know, wake up every morning thinking about 10 problems that I know that I couldn't work on by myself. Mm-hmm. But because of these teams that I'm in, we're doing things that are really fantastic. Well, let's imagine team 4 fails because the technology we needed to develop that we thought we could develop, we couldn't. Team 10 fails because, in fact, the idea, as fantastic as it was wrong. Mm. So now 2 out of 10 have gone down in flames. But, you know, 3 other of the teams are really going great guns. They're going to really do something fantastic. And maybe 2 others look pretty good. And so failure becomes an option. And we're not so afraid to ask bold and crazy things because there's some of those things are going to hit. If we can destigmatize failure in academic research, then the opportunity to ask and answer the really big questions opens up much more.
Well, Dr. Yamamoto, I think there's probably some parallels there from the way we approach educating the research professionals to thinking about the world of healthcare professional workforce training.
Yes.
And maybe yearning for a similar approach. And heavens knows there's no shortages of big challenges out there for us, from the aging population to chronic illness and all the other things that we know so well. What are your thoughts about the principles for transforming academia from the perspective of how we train the healthcare workforce of the future? And how is that training evolving at your institution?
Actually, there is a new medical curriculum that is just rolling out here called Bridges, UCSF Bridges, that has many elements of integration that I've been talking about built in, where the students begin to define and then act upon their refined interests in the medical profession as they proceed through medical school. And that includes a great opportunity for a long period of research, of discovery. And so the opportunity for medical students at UCSF to be able to integrate with that world is greatly increased. But, you know, we're a long way from being there. So on the PhD training side, there are still many programs around the country that kind of continue to use the conventional stand up and lecture and then examine the students to see how much they remember approach. You know, we're sort of past that now. We have in our pockets little devices that can remember everything in 3/10 of a second and so forth. So being able to build concepts and use them effectively is really critical. And an increasing number of programs, including ours, are beginning to build programs that focus on that sort of hands-on learning, project labs, team learning. Biological sciences has become a quantitative endeavor, changing over from a long successful period as a descriptive endeavor. So understanding quantitation, statistics, computation is really important. Developing a broad literacy across a spectrum of scientific approaches is really important, and we have a very rich research environment here that does that. That's all good, but integration, as I've been saying, is really key. And so now we're trying trying to develop ways to get those trainees together so they can see each other, talk to each other, see how their different approaches and aspirations can meld to be able to inform each other and to do really bold things. And I think that's the next frontier.
We've been speaking today with Keith Yamamoto, PhD, Vice Chancellor for Science, Policy, and Strategy, Executive Vice Dean for Research at the School of Medicine, and Director of the Precision Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. You can learn more about his work by going to yamamotolab.ucsf.edu. Dr. Yamamoto, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
House Speaker Paul Ryan falsely claimed that, quote, because of Obamacare, Medicare is going broke. The law actually improved Medicare's financing, and the program isn't going broke. Ryan made the remark in an interview on Fox News a few days after the presidential election. And Ryan's remark took us back to the 2012 election, which was filled with scary Medicare claims. As we said back then, both the Romney and Obama campaigns had proposed ways to shore up Medicare's shaky financing, but they disagreed on how best to do that. Let's start with the idea that Medicare is going broke. It isn't. One part of Medicare, though, is expected to face financial shortfalls in the future without changes to either revenues or spending or both. That's Part A, which covers payments to hospitals and is funded by a payroll tax that goes into a trust fund. It's that Part A trust fund that's expected to run out of money. The current exhaustion date is 2028, according to the latest report from the Medicare trustees. But that doesn't mean Medicare would be broke. Part A would still have revenue through payroll tax receipts. Those revenues would cover 87% of expenditures in 2028, the trustees estimate. Predictions of financing shortfalls have surrounded Part A almost since it became law in 1965, but Congress has repeatedly pushed back those dates, mainly through increasing taxes. As for Ryan's claim that Obamacare had worsened Medicare's financing, that's not the case either. In fact, the law both expanded Medicare funding and cut the growth of future spending. The trustees' 2010 report estimated that the ACA had added 12 years to the life of the Part A trust fund, postponing the exhaustion date from 2017 to 2029 or 2028 under an alternative scenario in which not all of the ACA changes are enacted. Cutting future growth in spending improves Medicare's financing. That's the opposite of what Ryan claimed. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. As the saying goes, music soothes the savage beast. And according to a recent study conducted by Queen's University in Belfast, Ireland, there's some empirical data to back that up. Children suffering from a variety of behavioral and emotional conditions who are exposed to music therapy in addition to traditional therapies had far better outcomes than those children in a control group that offered traditional therapy without music therapy.
It's not a matter of them being given music or choosing music. They actually make music along with the music therapist assisting them. So the idea is for them to express themselves through music.
Lead researcher Dr. Sam Porter said there's been anecdotal evidence that music improves mood in children and adolescents as well as adults, but his study revealed just how effective the music therapy was.
Our primary outcome was an improvement in communication. Now, there were two very interesting secondary outcomes, levels of depression and levels of self-esteem. And in the secondary outcomes, we find a statistically significant difference between the control group and the intervention group.
It showed over time more interaction with their surroundings and a better response to the traditional therapies as well.
I mean, that's one of the marvelous things about music therapy. There are no side effects, and it is a productive way of getting kids to improve their health. So it's really satisfying to know that it's also an effective way of doing it.
The study was conducted in conjunction with the Northern Ireland Music Therapy Trust, which sees the promising findings as an incentive to incorporate this relatively low-cost therapy to enhance outcomes for the youth population. A simple, targeted music therapy approach, age-appropriate and showing great efficacy in improving outcomes for young patients with minimal side effects and lasting benefits. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.